You're listening to the BBC World Service. And now, One Planet. Andrew Luckbaker investigates how big industry can cut its carbon emissions.
The BBC's One Planet programme starts today in the shadow of a gigantic oven. Above my head, a rust-stained steel tube, the width of an airliner and the length of two football pitches, is turning. Inside, volcanic temperatures are transforming rock dust into cement, the world's most consumed product after water. Globally, kilns like this one produce about 1.8 billion tonnes of cement each year, and as a result, put a similarly gargantuan amount of the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. If we really want to do something about global warming, the cement and other high-emission industries will have to change their way of doing business.
We can't get for free what we've had for free up until now. And the thing that we've had for free up until now is our ability to use the atmosphere to dispose of a waste product, namely carbon dioxide. And we haven't paid anything for it. We've just gone on doing it, and now we know that we can't go on doing it any longer because the costs of exceeding that waste disposal site, if you like, for carbon, are getting larger and larger. So we've got to pay something for what we've up until now had for free. And those businesses that are carbon intensive are going to end up paying more. That's, I'm sorry to say, the law of the marketplace.
Jonathan Porritt of the Forum for the Future, an NGO which advises industries on ways to reduce their carbon emissions. In the final part of this series on how the world can put the brakes on climate change, we'll be focusing on two industries. Both face unique challenges when it comes to emission reductions, but they also serve to highlight some general points about the global journey into a low-carbon future.
To be honest, the behaviour of the airlines and their trade associations over the last decade has been disgraceful. They've used every conceivable lobbying tactic under the sun to prevent the introduction of measures to bring them into a carbon management market. That is changing now.
Flying in an aircraft is akin to travelling in a rather old or large or inefficient car.
Paul Upham, a researcher on global warming and civil aviation at the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change in the UK. Consider, he says, the emissions from a middle-aged jumbo jet.
When you're flying with your fellow 747 passengers, it's as if you've got a whole fleet of slightly elderly cars up there. But it's not so much that aircraft are particularly inefficient relative to cars, say. It's the fact that there's so many of these hypothetical cars and they're travelling an awfully long way.
If we compare aircraft 40 years ago and aircraft today, I mean, the fuel consumption has improved 70%.
Philippe Rochin of the Air Transport Action Group, an international coalition of aircraft manufacturers, airlines and airports.
Today, modern aircraft consume no more than 3.5 litres of kerosene per 100 passenger kilometers. So I would say our performance is very comparable to the one of the most modern car. Technological progress also in the future is, let's say, the main tool in our hand to improve the situation.
The problem, though, says Paul Upham, is that for the foreseeable future, improvements in fuel efficiency will be outstripped by the increasing number of planes in the skies.
The efficiency gains have been considerable, and they're expected to be 2% per annum for new aircraft coming into the fleet. The problem is that air traffic growth rates are more like 4% and air passenger growth rates are higher. And so you've got this difference of 2 to 3% per year by which the efficiency gains are being outpaced by the sheer growth of the sector.
The UN's International Panel on Climate Change has calculated that aviation's contribution to global warming is about 3.5% at the moment. In fact, that's a much smaller share of the blame compared to the energy generation industry or road transport. But aviation is the fastest growing source of emissions, and unlike those other sectors, there are no alternative low carbon fuels on the horizon. Many experts outside the industry argue for economic levers. A vast web of international agreements means aviation fuel is uniquely privileged in not being taxed. But Jonathan Porritt of the Forum for the Future argues for the introduction of a carbon charge on air travel to constrain growing emissions.
My own belief is that we will have to see a proper charge, a tax on emissions that is levied proportionate to the emissions caused by that aeroplane flying that distance with that number of people aboard it. And that tax is then levied on the individual ticket, because that is the most effective economic instrument to mandate efficiency gains in the way people build engines, manage planes. I mean, I can't tell you how much CO2 is caused by bad management through air traffic control and poor control at airports.
At London's Gatwick Airport, I met up with Jan Steels of the European Low-Cost Airline Association. Her organisation argues that these kinds of emission-saving measures can be made without recourse to carbon charges or carbon taxes on passenger tickets. Jan Skiels claims carbon charging would penalise and threaten the survival of the budget industry.
You're assuming that whatever price is put onto the airlines, they will actually pass on to consumers by way of higher fares. Now, this doesn't necessarily follow. If you look at the big price hikes we've seen in the cost of fuel, a lot of low-fares airlines have actually found other ways of actually achieving cost efficiency savings so that the fares do not have to go up. Within Europe, there is a lot of competition for travel within Europe. So airlines can't simply just increase the fares. There are a lot of consumers out there who travel simply because of low airfares.
Excuse me, sir, can I interrupt your conversation just briefly? I'm from BBC Radio. Do you think we should pay more for our air tickets to discourage us from flying so much?
Certainly not. We pay enough. On a serious note, I think it's what we should do to try and counteract if there are these emissions, and we can use perhaps fuel that is not so detrimental to the atmosphere.
Why should we pay more for air travel? Do you ever see the amount of taxes we pay on an airline ticket? Like, add another one to the pile, jeez.
An alternative economic instrument to encourage industries to put less carbon into the atmosphere is to include them in an emissions trading market. Such markets have come into being as a result of the Kyoto Protocol. They allow companies and countries signed up to the treaty to either buy or indeed sell permits to emit certain amounts of carbon. This international carbon trade is designed to help the industrialized countries such as Japan, Canada, and those of the European Union to meet their emission reduction targets. It gives some flexibility on how those goals are achieved. Salimil Huk of the International Institute for Environment and Development explains.
These countries in Europe in particular, for instance, have had national plans for reductions, which they've then passed on to particular industries, which are the large emitting industries, like the transport sector or the cement sector or the energy providing sector. And companies have had quotas put on them by legislation to reduce their emissions by a certain amount by within the next 10 years or so. And these companies then have to look at ways of either reducing it themselves by becoming more energy efficient. And if they aren't able to do that, or it's too expensive for them to do that, they can meet their targets by buying in carbon reductions done perhaps less expensively elsewhere, either within Europe through the European trading scheme of carbon, or by trading with developing countries, where the developing countries themselves don't have any targets, but they are able to participate with other Kyoto countries to carry out projects which would reduce carbon emissions. And then the credits for those can be transferred to companies in the developed countries which do have targets to meet those targets.
The trade between companies in the developed and developing world is carried out through something called the Clean Development Mechanism, in which, for example, a Canadian cement company might pay for the building of a large renewable energy project in, say, India. The EU's emission trading scheme, which has been running 1 year, is between companies of any sector, but only within Europe. So, back to aviation. What effect might inclusion in the EU emissions trading scheme have on this industry? Paul Upham.
If you annually contract the upper cap, the total quantity of permits, then this will raise the price of carbon. And with aviation included in that, it's quite likely that ticket prices would rise and constrain demand.
We're talking ifs, mights and likelies here because at the moment, international air travel has been excluded from all emission trading schemes, at least for now. David Lee, an atmospheric scientist at Manchester Metropolitan University.
If we fly from Paris to Washington, who do those emissions belong to? Do we split them half-half? Do we split them by some other measure? Do we split them by the nationality of the passengers? This issue of so-called allocation of international aviation emissions was a problem recognised in putting the Kyoto Protocol together. So international emissions were excluded. International emissions of aviation globally are about 52%, so you've not dealt with, if you like, over half the problem.
However, in Europe, negotiations are underway to include the aviation industry in the EU emissions trading scheme. Because of the allocation issue, the plan may only cover flights between EU airports, and not those coming from or going to countries beyond Europe. The low-cost operators, which specialise in flying people within Europe, believe that that would put them at a competitive disadvantage.
If Europe wants to actually try to curb the emissions from aviation within European airspace, they simply have to look at the total aviation movements within European airspace and not just those from intra-European flights alone.
Speaking for the global industry, Philippe Rochat also lacks enthusiasm for emissions trading.
We are not entirely convinced that emission trading is the right solution for aviation. We'd say that we would prefer emission trading to taxes and charges. But on the other hand, we would prefer to focus on technological progress, on infrastructure improvements.
If the sector could just accept either stasis or a much lower growth, then there would be less of a problem.
Paul Upham also wants to see would-be passengers curbing their enthusiasm for ever more air travel.
Hopefully, as climate change bites, attitudes will change and people will begin to realise that we will take flights more sparingly. All the solutions that we have now that aren't being used, particularly video conferencing, all the telecom solutions, they will become, hopefully, more routine. It will no longer be seen as somewhat unusual to video conference with your colleagues or whoever you need to negotiate with in another country. It will be the norm.
Back to Earth now for a look at one of the most carbon-intensive manufacturing industries, cement. Arguably more proactive on its emissions than aviation, it has nevertheless some huge challenges. We start at the business end of a 30-year-old kiln at the Lafarge Cement Works, east of London. Our guide is area manager Tony Drake.
We're now standing at the front end of number 2 kiln. Through that small sight glass, you can see the flame.
It's looking almost white hot in there.
Yeah, it's actually being heated up now.
God, you can kind of feel the, you can feel the energy, can't you? It's quite amazing. What is the fuel that's burning inside there?
At the moment, it's diesel, and then you put the coal on.
So are we talking hundreds of tons of coal then going into this kiln?
A day, yeah.
Globally, the cement industry contributes close to 4% of all CO2 emissions. On a global scale, there is 1 billion tons of cement produced and consumed every year outside of China, and about 800 million tons in China alone.
India is the second largest producer of cement right now, after China. It accounts for around 6.3% of global production. China is 7 times larger than India. So China accounts for around 40% of the global cement production. The cement industry in India is growing at a rate of 10% per annum. So in next 10 years, Indian cement industry should double in size.
Chandra Bhusan of the Centre for Science and Environment in New Delhi and Jeff Sotin, Managing Director of Lafarge Cement UK. The cement and concrete needed for all those new buildings, roads and airports in Asia will mean this industry will have to work very hard indeed to reduce its role in climate change. To get a feel for the scale of the manufacturing process and the challenges, it's back to the cement works. Tony, you brought me up to the top of a giant circular tank about 20 metres in diameter, full of this light brown, gooey sort of liquid. Well, what is this?
This is slurry, which is a combination of chalk and clay mixed with water and crushed into a fine slurry that's then pumped here from our quarry.
So what happens to this liquid, this slurry then, after you've mixed it around?
It's stored in this tank and then it's pumped to our press house, where the moisture is then squeezed out in giant presses to form a cake, which is then fed into the kilns. We are currently standing at the back end of number two kiln, which is where the cake that's squeezed from the, in the press house, is fed into the back of the kiln.
And this kiln is absolutely huge. It's lying horizontally, but it's basically a huge, huge pipe, isn't it?
It's actually 550 foot long.
Which is about the length of two football pitches. So what's happening then? Are we at the end where the cooking up of the slurry mix?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The cake's fed in at this end, and then the cake is then worked through the kiln, where it's basically cooked. And there's a chemical reaction within the cake, and this combines and you end up with clinker coming out of the other end.
And what's clinker?
It's a very abrasive, nodule-y material, which is then ground into cement.
That noise is chains in the back of the kiln.
Alistair Gale, communications manager for Lafarge Cement UK. He explained where all the waste CO2 emissions come from.
In this process, you're getting the CO2 from two places. It's important to remember that at the far end of the kiln, we have an extremely hot flame. That's 2,000 degrees centigrade. We have to have that temperature of flame in order to create the chemical reaction. But when you burn fuels, and in this case we're burning coal and petroleum coke, you generate CO2. So that's one of the sources of CO2. The second one is that the actual chemical reaction, the process that takes place in the kiln, involves the driving off of CO2 as part of the chemical reaction to give you cement.
So the carbon dioxide is coming off what, the chalk element of the mix?
That's absolutely right. It's being driven out of the raw material mix.
How much CO2 comes from one tonne of cement produced?
It's slightly less than a tonne of CO2. But we're doing lots of things to actually decrease the amount of CO2 that we generate as an industry. For example, using carbon neutral fuels like meat and bone meal and processed sewage pellets. They are actually good fuels. I mean, there are a number of materials that you wouldn't expect to be used as a fuel, which are absolutely ideal for us. If you think of car tyres, a car tyre actually has as much energy in it, ton for ton, as a ton of coal, and it's a fantastic fuel for us.
Burning tyre rubber can release toxic chemicals if conditions aren't carefully controlled. Lafarge UK says their kilns are too hot for that, but in India, Chandra Bhusan says this issue needs further scrutiny.
It has both pros and cons. The cons are that we don't know very much about the incineration aspect of waste when it is burnt in cement kiln. Though industry claims that it doesn't contribute to the release of dioxin, furans and heavy metals, we don't know much about it. On the other hand, industry has a strong point in saying that I'm substituting carbon fuel with something which is a waste. But we have to watch this out much more carefully. What we have done is to do a model project for next 2 years, document the results, and then see how do we move ahead with it. Because it's too risky, so one needs to be cautious about it. And if the results are fine, I think we should move ahead with it.
India's rapid economic growth is fueling a near insatiable demand for cement and concrete. But ton for ton, Dr. Bhusan's research suggests that his country's cement companies produce lower CO2 emissions than counterparts in most developed countries.
If I compare Indian cement industry with the global companies, global cement industry, then other than Japan and Germany, Indian cement industry is far better than the rest of the European countries, as well as United States, Canada and Australia. As far as environment performance of manufacturing is concerned, energy consumption is concerned, and greenhouse gas emission is concerned.
This is largely because many of India's cement works are new and kitted out with the latest, most efficient technologies. But according to Jeff Sotan at Lafarge Cement UK, the industry in Britain has been able to make significant emission reductions in the last decade and looks set to achieve a goal it set itself for 2012.
Where we've pledged, for example, a reduction of about 20% of CO2 emissions on the horizon of Kyoto, and I think we're on track to achieve that. We are hitting a little bit of a plateau right now because we've picked up the low-hanging fruits, and therefore now we're dependent on research. So it becomes much more speculative. I think we are showing that we should be able to get another 20% as a result of research, but the next 20% reduction are not quite as well charted as, you know, the low-hanging fruits that we've already picked.
Jonathan Porritt recognizes the efforts the cement industry is making to decarbonize its act, but points out that the rate of expansion globally means emissions are still going to rise. It may well be that the only solution is a completely new and expensive technological one.
You only have to look at the speed with which an economy like China's is growing, and you think about how much concrete is going to be poured over the next decade in China to get a handle on precisely how hard it is to translate those efficiency gains into absolute reductions in CO2 emissions. You've got relative improvements in performance, but absolutely, i.e. net emissions across the global economy as a whole, that curve continues to head absolutely in the wrong direction.
Which doesn't sound in the least bit optimistic, and that takes us back to, do we give up?
No. Even in the cement industry, there is a way of handling this. The technology that they're beginning to focus on is something called carbon capture and storage, which means that you capture the CO2 in the flue gases. You then find a way of getting that carbon dioxide re-injected back into oil and gas, geological strata, whatever it might be.
Carbon capture and storage is something the biggest CO2 emitters, the fossil fuel and energy generation industries, are also exploring. But given the colossal costs of keeping carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere by this and other means we've covered in this BBC series, will the global economy cope?
Very carbon-intensive businesses are going to have to work very hard. But the idea that we're going to stop growing is wrong. It's a myth that is peddled by people who've spent the last 20 years denying the science of climate change. They can no longer deny the science of climate change. So all they can do now is talk about the economics and that this is going to destroy options for growth across the economy. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. It will change the pattern of economic growth that we generate to improve people's standard of living.
One Planet was presented by Andrew Luck Baker and produced by Geraldine Fitzgerald.
BBC. Tension.